Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. From Wondery.
On this episode of Generation Y, I'm welcoming Mark Howard and Marty Tankliff. And I'd like for both of you to introduce yourselves so that the audience is clear on who you are. Many of the people listening know who Marty is. At least they have some idea. But Mark, let's start with you.
Sure. So I'm Mark Howard. I'm a professor of government and law at Georgetown University, where I founded and direct the Prisons and Justice Initiative, which is an organization that works on wrongful convictions, that teaches and provides courses inside of prisons and jails, and eventually we'll be offering Georgetown degrees. And we also have some reentry programs for formerly incarcerated people. And on the side, I also recently founded a nonprofit called the Frederick Douglass Project for Justice, which seeks to bring in tens of thousands of visitors inside of prisons and jails to connect with the tremendous humanity of people that are behind prison walls.
Thank you, Mark. And Marty?
Sure. Hi, my name is Marty Tankliff. I was wrongfully convicted of the murder of my parents. In 1990, I was wrongfully incarcerated for almost 18 years. Since I've been free, I've been able to get my Juris Doctor degree. I'm an admitted lawyer in New York State. I'm an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, where Mark Howard and I co-teach a class, which we've nicknamed Making an Exoneree. And I also teach a wrongful conviction class at Toro Law School. And I work for a law firm in Manhattan. And I'm proud to have the opportunity to work with Mark and speak to your audience.
I remember when I recorded the episode on your case, Marty, the thing that stuck out to me was just how many people came forward and how a court unanimously found that you were wrongfully convicted. So that stuff is unique because generally speaking, it seems like when people have their conviction tossed, it's a whole other thing to be able to say, I'm exonerated. And so many don't get that. So the question becomes, when we have people who are wrongfully convicted, but they can't get to that next step of exoneration, it seems like it takes a village or the nation almost to make anything move. And so what do we tell people when they're just starting out to get involved in this stuff, where should they go first? Because it seems like we can get the information. We know people are wrongfully convicted, but then we don't know how do we help people or how can we make a difference?
So I could say that's no easy task. I was recently brought into a wrongful conviction case from Pennsylvania, and one of the women involved had been involved in some death penalty cases when an execution date was set. And she was so gung-ho. She's like, can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do this? And I tried to explain to her, I said, wrongful conviction cases are so much different because you need to take everything step by step. And if you step the wrong way or somewhere along the line, you may miss a statutory deadline. You may rush to get something into court and the court could turn around and say it's not enough. And so for wrongful conviction case, I think it really is coming up with a strategy. And to do that, you need to understand where the case has been before and the direction you want the case to go. And you need to assemble what I would say is an army or a team of people that can work on different aspects of the case. And that is no easy task. Mark and I have had the opportunity to work on these cases, and you know, we're very fortunate to have students work with us. But we've learned that it really does take a village. You know, in my case, there was probably over 24 lawyers that worked on the case. And if somebody wanted to figure out where do you start, you really have to start back from day one. Because in a lot of the wrongful conviction cases, we find it really does stem from what wasn't done. And what I mean by what wasn't done is what aspect of the case wasn't investigated. Did the law enforcement or the prosecutors have what we can call institutional blinders, where they focus on one individual and that's all they do, is they isolate their investigation around that one individual. In a lot of the cases we work on, when we start delving into the paperwork, we find that, oh my God, there was 5-10 other suspects, but there was no pursuit of those suspects. So what you really need to do is, and I say, is that one of the primary people and probably the most important person in a post-conviction case is finding the right private investigator. Because in so many of these cases, what you really want is to uncover new evidence, because that really is what will get you in the door, either in the court system or through a conviction integrity bureau or an innocence project of the DA's office. Because if you have new evidence acquired by a private investigator, you can get the lawyers involved. So I think that getting the private investigator first, your lawyer second, and then somebody who does public relations or public advocacy would be third.
Now, both of you teach, you said you co-teach a class about wrongful convictions. Mark, can you give kind of an overview of what that entails?
Sure. So first off, it's an undergraduate class, which is something that most members of the media, when they report on our class, get wrong, even though we're always telling them these are not law students. These are undergraduates who are, you know, 20, 21, 22 years old. And basically, it's a very competitive class to get into, actually. We have almost 100 applicants for just 15 spaces. So there's been a lot of excitement around the Georgetown campus around it. And we have them reinvestigate cases. So we're not doing legal work ourselves. We're actually doing investigative work, which means we're taking a case and going back to square one and looking into what investigation took place and then trying to see if we find another narrative. Now, we pick cases that we already have a strong sense may have been wrongful convictions, but we do an independent investigation. And that's what we task our students with, where they create documentaries that try to make the case for innocence, if that's what we come to believe, which we do in almost all of the cases that we've picked. And what we find really just about every single time is that within even just a few weeks of, you know, some undergraduate students reinvestigating a case, is that we find a much more complex story and ultimately more accurate story than what the police and prosecutors told at trial. And that's really disturbing. And so our class has managed to get one exoneration already, Valentino Dixon, who was exonerated just 4 months after our first class had ended, thanks to evidence that the students had uncovered. We have several more exonerations that we hope are coming, where we've made tremendous progress, and we think there's a real chance for exoneration coming soon. But even in the other cases, some of which have reached dead end, some of which we're trying to find legal representation for our quote-unquote clients, What we found is a shocking level of ineptitude, of incompetence, and really maliciousness involved in the framing of a person who was likely innocent. And that should shake everyone to the core. In other words, it's not just about the ultimate exoneration. And what we have come to realize is that people like Marty and Valentino are ultimately the lucky ones because they actually got out. And there are tens of thousands of people in prison who don't even get the chance. And then even when they do get an opportunity to make a compelling case for their innocence, it is so hard to overturn a wrongful conviction. So I think what we're showing is that our criminal justice system is deeply and fundamentally broken, and that there are good ways in which ordinary people, students, and others could potentially play a role in helping to correct injustices.
I'm not sure who to direct this question to, maybe to both of you, but it seems like when I've read comments by prosecutors who have successfully gotten convictions which have later been overturned, there's this idea that it really just comes down to, we made an argument that was accepted by the jury, so we're not wrong. And I wonder how we can connect them from there to the fact that they were essentially wrong. Like, how do we bridge that gap? Because it seems like there's such a disconnect there.
I was going to say, you take it from an academic standpoint, and I'll take it from the exoneree standpoint.
Absolutely. The problem of prosecutorial error / misconduct, and sometimes it is genuine error in good faith, other times it's full-on misconduct, unethical behavior. It's fundamental. It goes into every single wrongful conviction case that's been unearthed, that's been overturned, but also so many of the others that we'll never hear about. And that's because of a couple things. One is that prosecutors have as their motivation, as their incentive to win. And to win in our adversarial system that we have in the United States is to get a conviction, which means that when there is ambiguity, when there's lack of information, when there's information that goes in different directions, the incentive is to cut all of the noise out and to simply paint a very simple picture that is of guilt of the person who's being charged. And so there's so many incidents that we find of what are called Brady violations, when the prosecutors have discovered evidence that actually is favorable to the defendant and they don't turn it over, even though they're constitutionally obligated to do so. But routinely, they're not turning that over, which is leading to wrongful convictions. But then perhaps a deeper problem, or at least morally even more troubling, is that prosecutors face no consequences for their role in wrongful convictions. And so they'll spin some tale and they'll create some fiction that they'll spin to a jury that will lead a jury to convict. And that's actually not nearly as hard as you might think, and certainly not what you see on TV shows. Almost all juries wind up convicting and following the kind of stature and office of the state's attorneys and prosecutors. And so the motivation is to get a conviction. And then once they do, it's to dig their heels in and oppose any type of reinvestigation, any uncovering of, you know, alternative suspects or other evidence that they had. And then ultimately, when it, even despite all of their efforts, it gets overturned and you get an exoneration, there are no consequences, zero consequences. In a few cases, prosecutors have been disbarred, but in countless other cases, they've simply said that, well, we did the best we could given the evidence we've had. There are no criminal consequences. There are no civil consequences. Prosecutors have full immunity. And I think that is so outrageous and leads to a protection of what is essentially immoral and really, I think, should be criminal and criminalized behavior on the part of prosecutors in wrongful conviction cases. So what we're helping to do is shine the light on these practices that unfortunately are routine, and hopefully at some point to push in the direction of consequences. Because if there are consequences, prosecutors won't actually undertake those behaviors and make those choices. But unfortunately, right now, the incentives are entirely towards getting a conviction. And then there are no consequences for having had a conviction that was actually incorrect and wrongful. But Marty can talk about it from his own experience.
I mean, I think one of the biggest problems with prosecutors and wrongful convictions, and I really hate to use the word wrongful convictions because so many of these convictions are intentional. When we talk about wrongful, we think of a mistake. But when you have a prosecutor who intentionally withholds evidence, that's intentional. When you have a police officer who intimidates witnesses, that's intentional. When you have a police officer who bribes witnesses, that's intentional. And if you think about all the intentional acts that occur in a lot of wrongful conviction cases, there's nothing wrongful about it. It's sinister, it's evil, and it's intentional. And what we find a lot of times is that prosecutors never question what a detective or a police officer brings them. So if you have a detective who brings to a prosecutor a witness, and the witness says, I was at the crime scene, I saw Jim Smith shoot Bobby Jones, the prosecutor doesn't even really question that witness or the detective, because quite often they've had a long-standing working relationship. And I think that's a problem. When prosecutors start accepting everything that's brought to them without questioning the accuracy of it, that leads to wrongful convictions. One of the other problems, and this is something that happened in my case, was the lead detective was bringing witnesses into the evidence locker room prior to them testifying, showing them crime scene photos, showing them pieces of evidence, in an effort to intimidate the witnesses to testify a certain way. Additionally, one of the detectives intimidated three young girls to testify a certain way. And it wasn't until after I was free that a private investigator spoke to one of the girls who said, we all lied because the cops made us lie. And the problem there is because when you start looking back at the facts, the three girls all said I was at their house on a particular day and looked a particular way. Had the prosecutor done his due diligence to find out the day they were talking about what I actually looked like that day, he would have realized all three of them were committing perjury. And that's one of the biggest issues, that when prosecutors know a witness is not telling the truth, they actually have an ethical duty to correct that testimony. However, rarely, if ever, do they do that, because so many of them have failed to recognize that their duty is to seek justice, not merely convictions. But the problem becomes, and I think the media in some ways is a motivating factor, is when you have a high profile case, society demands that there is an arrest and a prosecution and a conviction. And I find this all too often when I ask a group of people, I say, if there was a murder in your community on Monday, and all of a sudden Wednesday, the police say we've arrested somebody, how many of you are comfortable with they've arrested the right person? And almost everyone in the room raises their hand. And I say, what if it's not the right person? And everyone in the room says, well, we never thought of that because the police said they arrested the right person. That's one of the problems, is we don't kind of almost ensure that law enforcement is doing the right job arresting the right person. Because if you think about it, how many wrongful conviction cases would have been avoided, or how many intentionally innocent men and women were wrongfully convicted, if law enforcement would just have done a proper investigation, taking their time. And I think that's one of the biggest issues, is that there's a rush to judgment, there's a rush to arrest, there's a rush to prosecute. And when there's a rush in all of these aspects, we end up with too many innocent men and women being wrongfully convicted and serving decades in prison.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
That's well said. One thing about your case in particular, Marty, is when I first had heard of it, and I may have said this on the episode, but when you first read about what happened and the investigator's theory on what happened and who had done it, meaning you, it makes sense. But that has nothing to do with justice. Justice requires that there be an investigation, that you put the facts together, that you vet the information. So it doesn't matter what our perceptions are. There should be some sort of responsibility on those that are supposed to bring justice to actually do it the right way. And it so often feels like all they have to do is present their case. And if they win it, they've done their job. But this is all... The reason this is so important is because it involves people. And I think it's so often lost on the public who wants someone arrested, someone convicted. There are people involved. And so, you know, you get sent away for 20 years. We haven't even discussed what happens to someone who gets put away. I mean, so many come out with PTSD, don't they?
Oh, without a doubt. And I think there's a few issues that we're missing here, too, is that when a prosecutor's office convicts the wrong person, they have been part of the victimizing aspect of it, because what they've done is they've sent an innocent person to prison. They've sent their family and friends to prison. They've allowed the guilty party to remain free in the community to commit additional crimes and victimize other people. That's why it's so important when we talk about accountability. When a prosecutor and police officers are involved in sending an innocent person to prison, allowing the guilty parties to remain free to victimize other people, there should be some accountability, because there are cases where they've sent an innocent person to prison for murder, and the real murderer went on to kill someone else. Why shouldn't that prosecutor, that police officer, have some accountability because they put an innocent person in prison, which allowed a murderer to kill someone else? There's something wrong with that whole picture, because we're talking about human lives. And when prosecutors and police intentionally do wrong and there's no accountability, what's stopping them from doing it again and again and again, just like we saw in the Scarcella cases in Brooklyn?
Yeah, let me just add to that, because that is so important. And, you know, Marty and I know several people in that situation. One of them, Jeff Deskovic, who was wrongfully convicted, spent 16 and a half years in prison. There was actually even DNA evidence at the time that excluded him, but there had been they coerced a false confession out of him after manipulative hours and so on of disgusting police interrogation. And the jury believed the false confession over the DNA evidence. And Jeff spent almost 17 years trying over and over to get the DNA tested and match with a database, the CODIS database that has all of the people convicted of crimes. And when he finally did, almost two decades later, it matched someone else who had raped and killed another woman. And to me, those prosecutors who just relentlessly and frankly, I think knowingly, went after the wrong person because they wanted their conviction, that the other death, that blood is on them. That's on their hands. That was conduct. And to think that they're acting and representing the state, the people, and that's what they do. They ruin someone's life, in this case, Jeff, by sending him to prison for so long. And then another person dies as a result. And this has happened over and over and over in wrongful conviction cases. And I think it just can't be stressed enough how this supposed kind of, it's part of a tough on crime reaction. Like, we've got to put some away for this. We got to make someone pay. Justice is about, you know, closure. Well, if that closure is the wrong closure, you're actually opening up the possibility of more crime, more victims. And that should be linked together. And I think there should be consequences for that.
Mark, one of the things that I noticed was when you speak up about it, even in an individual case, and you say, in this case, and we could say Marty's case, we can go through and list what the prosecutors did wrong, what the investigators did wrong. But sometimes the response you get back from some in the public is, oh, you're anti-law enforcement, you're anti-prosecutors. And it couldn't be further from the truth for me. I mean,
no,
we need those people. We need them. But the thing is just because you're criticizing doesn't mean you hate someone. It just means what's been happening isn't acceptable. And there needs to be a better way of implementing the system, meaning, as we've already discussed so far, accountability. And
Absolutely. You
want accountability because it makes things run better. If you have a CEO of a company and their decisions have ended up ruining the company's stock, essentially, you don't just hold on to them because you like them. You have to make a decision to better the company and make it better for the employees and the stockholders.
That's right. And actually, many of the prosecutors who were involved, particularly in high profile cases that led to wrongful convictions, by the time that exoneration might come around, they're judges. They've been promoted. Those cases actually make their careers, which is adds another element of kind of disgust, I think, to this. But let me say, Aaron, that I completely agree. I'm not anti-prosecutor. I'm not anti-state. I'm not anti-law enforcement. I think that it is a tremendous, it's a responsibility and it's a privilege to be an agent of the state. And it's one that requires the highest ethical integrity. And that's why I'm so negative and critical about those who abuse it. Most don't, right? And I think most prosecutors are not. I'm not trying to in any way subsume all prosecutors and all law enforcement, but those who are involved and play an active role in wrongful conviction should have consequences, because what they're doing is actually bringing down trust and belief and legitimacy of the whole state institution. And that's really troubling. And so I think that, you know, when I have students who say, oh, you know, they learn in my class or in the class with Marty that we do on wrongful convictions, say, oh, I want to go be a public defender. I tell them, you know what, you can do that and that's great, but why don't you become a prosecutor and be an ethical prosecutor, which means push back against the pressures for conviction over justice and live up to your ethical duties. When you look at what the ethical duties of prosecutors are, they're actually beautiful. I completely support and agree with them, but we need to have our practice, our conduct match the ethical responsibilities. And that's where wrongful convictions show how often there's a huge gap between the two. And that's what's really troubling.
When you get a prosecutor who's trained by somebody who may have a unethical background, or have conducted some wrongdoing in his background, he passes those traits on to those young prosecutors. And that becomes a problem. When you have a prosecutor that has a history of what you could say is almost doing dirty, and everyone in the office knows that, they realize or they have this inherent belief that they can get away with doing dirty. That recently happened in Suffolk County where we had a new district attorney. He had a new policy about disclosure of Brady material. And all of a sudden, it was uncovered that an assistant district attorney from the prior administration had been withholding Brady material in several high-profile cases. So it really does have a lot to do with the training of your prosecutors. And something I've said for the longest that I think new prosecutors should meet with exonerees to help identify issues that they should be looking for when they get these types of cases, that there's some aspect of it that should raise a red flag.
Mark, let's say you have a wrongful conviction, but then it's overturned. And so often, and again, it's not every prosecutor, but there are prosecutors out there who dig their heels in.
Oh, yeah. Almost all do.
But why do you feel that we don't have more apologizing? Because some do, some have. But what's so difficult for someone to say, I'm sorry? Because forget about your own pride, but someone went away to prison for 5, 10, 20 years because you convicted them. You made the argument and you won, but now their life is impacted. And as Marty has said, you know, the families are impacted, the society is impacted. Why not just say, I'm sorry? Where is the humanity here? Where is the concern for getting it right?
Yeah, Aaron, that's a great question. You know, and to be honest, I ask myself that almost every day. But the empirical evidence shows that it's extraordinarily rare when you'll have a prosecutor say, I'm sorry, I messed up. It's on me. I'm deeply apologetic. Instead, what you have is either trying to pass the buck, which is, you know, oh, let's say it's incontrovertible that there was, you know, no doubt anymore that it was a wrongful conviction. They'll say, you know, we didn't know. Based on what we saw, we thought it was accurate. They'll try to minimize any role and agency they had in pursuing that conviction. But then in other cases, they will try to cast doubt and they'll say, well, the person was exonerated, but we still think he's guilty. We still think he did it. We were right. You know, they'll pitch themselves as victims. And I think ultimately it comes down to a very basic human response, which is not wanting to say you were wrong. And if you think about any, you know, person who's married, who has an argument with a spouse, you know, there's this reaction where it's always the other person. It's always the other person. And in this case, it's not just about something trivial. It's about someone's life who was deeply damaged, you know, or wasted, or at least a significant portion of that life was due to your mistakes. Yet somehow people rarely will say, I was wrong and I'm sorry. And I think that's a real problem. And I think we need to be building into the institutions of prosecutors' offices a mechanism for apologizing, for recognition, for saying, because I think, frankly, if you did that, there would be a much better response from people like us saying, you know what? I appreciate the fact that, you know, they screwed up and maybe they did some things that, you know, were really wrong, but at least they owning up to it. That would be a huge step in the right direction. But I see very few of those steps happening.
Mark, when we first talked, you had said that you got into this idea of justice reform because of Marty Tankleff and that you've known him for a long time. Can you give us a little overview of how long you've known Marty and how you became friends?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an amazing story because we go back to preschool. We've known each other since we were 3 years old. We went to a preschool called Lovey Dovey. We then went to the same elementary school, you know, junior high school, high school, and grew up in the same community. And so when Marty's parents were killed on September 7, 1988, which is the first day of our senior year in high school, you know, it's a day that I'll never forget. It's a day that was just so shocking to everyone in our community, everyone in our student body. And I was at the time covering it. I was the editor of our little high school newspaper called The Purple Parrot. And I was covering the story. And even I, as a kid who just turned 17, Marty and I are, by the way, we're 9 days apart in age. And I was covering the case and I realized Marty didn't do it. I don't care what the headlines say, what the prosecutors are saying, what the local media is saying. From my objective analysis of the case, it became obvious that Marty's father's business partner was the person who was involved, who had motive, who had opportunity, who had every means and motive to carry out this crime. And so I wrote about it and, you know, it got drowned out. Obviously, who reads a little high school newspaper? But, you know, I believed in Marty. And then when he was convicted, you know, that I'd moved on, I'd gone to college. We joke now and say, you know, Mark went to Yale, Marty went to jail. and I moved on with my life. But I would always tell people, I have a friend in prison who's innocent. And at the time, before the Innocence Project existed, before DNA technology had been developed, people didn't believe me, to be honest. You know, they thought I was a little nuts when I would say that, because the belief back then was that, you know, our criminal justice system is the greatest in the world, that you have the presumption of innocence, you have guilt beyond reasonable doubt, you've got a jury system. And, you know, people thought I was a little nuts, but then I would tell them more about the case and they go, wow, that's crazy. And so for years, I would be telling people about Marty. And then at one point, we reconnected and we started writing letters. You know, I have several shoeboxes full of Marty's letters from prison. And then I started visiting him and we became very close. And, you know, we then embarked on a journey. We didn't really know at the time where it would lead us. But now, you know, we're working together. We're in touch almost daily. You know, we've got students who are mobilized. We've gotten already one exoneration together. We've got more coming. Our lives have become so deeply intertwined. And our friendship has become just so, so powerful and inspirational. And so, you know, it's who would have thought that at Lovey Dovey Preschool, this crazy journey would have gotten underway. But, you know, we're still going places and we've got, you know, more people that we want to get out and more laws that we want to change and public opinion overall that we want to change. And really, for me, it all started with Marty and his exceptional courage and strength and going through his ordeal. It inspired me to change my life. I went to law school initially when Marty was still in prison. My goal was to get him out of prison. And then I've just kept going and got my law degree. And then Marty got his law degree. We're both now lawyers, members of the New York Bar. So our lives are really so intertwined and connected that it's pretty extraordinary.
Anything to add, Marty?
There's a lot to add. I just want to say is that, you know, just want to step back for a second, talk about prosecutors. You know, many people think that I despise prosecutors. I despise law enforcement. It's really the farthest thing from the truth. I despise the ones who are bad. And there are so many good ones. You know, in the Valentino Dixon case, Mark and I got to meet, you know, from the district attorney all the way down to the assistant district attorneys that did the investigation. And, you know, even for them, they were so honored to work on the case. And it just opened their eyes because they said it was one of the most challenging and difficult cases they've ever had to work on because they realized an innocent person was in prison. And I think when prosecutors step back and hopefully their human life or the human angle should really sink in and think about, you know, before there's a conviction, they have to say, is this the right, you know, am I doing right here? And I really revert back to one of my lawyers who worked on a case where a young man was accused of killing a four-year-old boy on, I think it was Easter Sunday, on his way to church. And the lawyer is Bruce Marquette, and I was working at Bruce's office during the beginning of the case. And Bruce said to me, he's like, Marty, guys, the guy's innocent. The guy's innocent. I said, well, how come the prosecutors won't listen? He goes, I don't know. You know, every time we come up with a new piece of evidence and we show it to them, the prosecutors just don't want to listen. They finally went to trial. Bruce made the opening statement in the case, and thank God for the judge who was on the case. After the opening statement, the judge said to Bruce, said, you know, have you told the line assistant everything you just said in court today? And Bruce said, Your Honor, I've been trying to tell them for 2 years, they just won't listen to me. And the judge, with his great wisdom and integrity, said, would you consent to a mistrial if I get you a meeting with the DA and hopefully new prosecutors will be assigned? After consulting with his client, they agreed. There was a mistrial granted. New prosecutors were assigned. 45 days later, the murder charges were dismissed against Nicholas Morris, and he was freed from jail. And it was about 6 or 7 years later, the actual murderer was arrested and charged with the murder. And to me, there's two aspects to that. One, it was the defense lawyer who was persistent, but it was also the judge in that case. And I think what ended up happening there was the judge saw that something was wrong, and he brought it to the attention of the lead prosecutor, not the line assistant. Because the line assistant just stood his ground and refused to listen to what Bruce was saying. And I think that's where it's so important, too, is that our defense lawyers, number one, are really take a hard stance when they believe their client is innocent. And I also think we need to make sure that our process, our defense lawyers, either public defenders or private lawyers, aren't overworked. Two big issues. But as far as Mark goes, we really do joke about from jail to jail. But if it wasn't for Mark, there's a part of me that I wouldn't be where I am today. Mark got, involved in my life when I was in prison, and he made a commitment that he would go to law school, he would fight to get me out. Thankfully, and before he even went to law school, he was very active working with the defense lawyers for the, the individuals that led the public campaign to free me. He wrote an amicus brief or a friend of the court brief on behalf of himself and I think almost 60 of my high school classmates. So he was a lawyer before he was a lawyer. And he really just became an inspiration to me. And how could I not want to go to law school and join him in the fight? Because, how many people don't have Mark Howards in their life? And through the work, we found that so many of the innocent people we work on, they said, we never had somebody to listen to us. We never had somebody who was willing to be our voice. And I think Mark and I have become the voice for so many voiceless individuals that it really is it's probably some of the most rewarding work we do. Our students who leave our class have said that it was probably the best experience they've ever had in college. And for many of the students, it was such an impact on their lives that they haven't been able to walk away from the cases. And I think that's just a telltale sign of Mark and I, our relationship, and what we can do to impart on the students that what we're teaching them is more than just reinvestigating cases. It's about humanity. It's about understanding who you are as individuals. It's about proving to them that they can accomplish just about anything they put their heart and mind to. It's about overcoming fears that they may have about society, or dealing with those people who are incarcerated, or pursuing justice. And so many of our students are so inspired by the incarcerated individuals that they walk away saying, we'll never stop doing this work. And I think to us, it just gives us more motivation to, move forward and continue doing this work and expand on what we're doing. As Mark said, he started his new not-for-profit. And I think the more people that see what we're doing, the more they want to get involved. Because when you see undergraduate students taking a 5-credit class as a junior or a senior, working 20 to 30 hours outside of class, traveling to Texas, to Rhode Island, to, to wherever the cases are, I think it becomes very inspiring to others to want to do this work and help out.
You had said that there was an exoneration already due to the class that you teach. And I find this interesting because both of you have your knowledge, you have your experiences, and you say that this can happen, but now you've seen it in action. So could you give the audience an overview of that case and how it got overturned?
Sure. So Valentino Dixon spent 27 years in prison, most of them in Attica, the notorious prison in upstate New York. And he was arrested. And 2 days later, another person named Lamar Scott confessed to the crime live on television in tremendous detail. Yet they had already arrested and charged Valentino Dixon. And so the prosecutors had a problem, which was they had the wrong guy and they knew they had the wrong guy. But what they did is they doubled down and they pushed Lamar Scott away and threatened him with other things and made sure he wouldn't testify. And then they got Valentino Dixon convicted. Valentino had a defense attorney who was reprehensible, who made no opening statement, called no witnesses, and made no closing statement, and didn't cross-examine any witnesses. There were a couple witnesses who had blatantly lied and who were later shown to have been incentivized and to have had no knowledge whatsoever. Over the years, the same person, Lamar Scott, kept repeating multiple times on camera. There are at least five incidents that were filmed where he was saying, Valentino Dixon did not commit that murder. I did. And yet Valentino is still in prison. So we took up that case. There's another side story that we probably don't have time to get into, which is Valentino is an extraordinary artist, and he drew golf courses, and he became kind of a mini celebrity while in prison drawing golf courses that was picked up by Golf Digest and the Golf Channel. And that's how we first heard about him. So there was the art and golf connection. But when our students worked on his case, they ended up interviewing the original prosecutor. And he had since retired. He had time on his hands. And he gave the students an interview, which for him turned out to be him giving a lecture and really kind of trying to show off to the students about how much he knew. But it turns out the students knew a lot more than he did about the actual case that he had prosecuted. And so they started running in circles around him, asking him questions. He started slipping up. He started sweating, getting nervous. And then at some point, he slipped up from his script, and he admitted to the fact that they had conducted gunpowder residue testing on Valentino's hands and clothing, and that had come back negative. And that, turns out, had never been revealed to the defense. And that then went to Valentino had a lawyer at the time, and that went immediately into his motion based on new evidence that they had just discovered about the not turning over the negative gunpowder residue testing. And several months after the class ended, Valentino walked out of prison into our arms. We were there with his family. We were there for his first meal. And we've been with him, you know, many times along the way. We talk to him and see him regularly. We've done many events together. We've hosted him at Georgetown multiple times. You know, it's been a beautiful story and triumph. And Valentino is such a wonderful person that it, again, makes you think that he's been deprived from society. Society's been deprived of him and his talents for so long. He got to meet Tiger Woods. He went to the Masters. He met Jack Nicklaus. He makes such a great impression on so many people, and he's really become so appreciated in the golf world in particular. But, you know, Marty and I are really proud that we set up a course with undergraduate students where they were able to get him out of prison, because otherwise he would still be there.
And I think what's interesting about it is there's a little backstory to it, is that I was working at a law firm that was representing Valentino. And while I was in Toro Law School, we set up a wrongful conviction externship program. And Valentino's case was one of the cases that the students were working on. And the case wouldn't go anywhere. We couldn't get any movement. And I made a commitment to Valentino. I said, listen, I said, there's going to come some point in the future where I'm going to be able to help you. And when Mark and I decided to teach the class at Georgetown, Valentino's case was one of the cases that the students could choose from. And we didn't push the case. The students could have picked some other case. You know, thankfully, the students chose Valentino's case. And as he said, you know, he said in one of his interviews, he goes, I knew once Georgetown was involved, I was going home. It's one of those great lines where you just see the smile perk up. And the other thing is that the three students who worked on this case were all foreign exchange students. We had a young man from Japan, a young woman from France, and a young woman from England. And I think for each of them to be able to be involved, you know, in a class where you have a direct impact on someone's life at such a young age, I mean, you have to think about it, that Valentino has served more time in prison than they're alive on this earth. And for two of them to be able to be there the day he walked out of prison has to be one of the greatest days of their lives, because you essentially helped get his life back. And Valentino's lawyers essentially said, if it was not for the students and the work that they did, Valentino may still be in prison. So I revert back that, you know, had Mark not gone to law school and fought for me, had I not set up the externship program, had we not been working Valentino's case, you know, all these little coincidences, you know, we may not have been fortunate enough to work on Valentino's case, and he may not be free right now, but he's free. He's doing great. And we're thrilled for that. And we really look forward to having other cases turn out just like Valentino's, maybe not as quickly after the class ends, but we're confident that we will achieve more exonerations.
Yeah, we have more coming. I mean, we have several that have gone in front of conviction integrity units that have a real chance. We have others that now have legal teams in place that didn't have them before. We're working on a case right now of someone who was on death row for 32 years and then was exonerated, and then it was reversed on the most insane technicality you could ever imagine, even though he's demonstrably innocent and he's now back on death row. We're talking real insane cases. And for people who are in prison wrongfully convicted, there's a hopeless feeling that they have for much of their incarceration. But when they connect with us, and especially having the angle with Marty, knowing that Marty has been there, he's actually been in their shoes, he knows what they're going through, he knows what it's like, it gives them a sense of hope and just joy that someone is fighting for them. I mean, we had someone recently that we actually did a video call with who's been in prison for, I think it's 25 years. He just burst into tears. He goes, "For the first time, I feel like someone's fighting for me." It was incredibly moving. And we're getting this over and over. We do about 5 cases per semester. This is our 3rd semester doing it. We do it every spring semester. Even now with COVID-19 and the situation, our students are doing this now through Zoom, through video. It's extraordinary what they're doing. The work has not slipped a beat. And we're just really proud of our students and of what we're able to accomplish. And we think that, you know, in some amount of time, we're going to have multiple more exonerations coming, because we really believe that we've discovered a person's innocence, and we just want to be able to prove it and show it.
The movie Just Mercy came out earlier this year, and there was a scene in there where after Michael B. Jordan holds the evidentiary hearing and Jamie Foxx talks about that even if he had to serve the rest of his time in prison, he feels free because the truth finally came out. Some of the men that we've worked on, they feel the same way. They feel that for so many years, the truth has never come out. Because we try to instill in our students that, you know, what we do is very difficult. We're not the decision makers. Sometimes the statutory avenues are very limited, and sometimes getting back into court is virtually impossible. But if our students are able to uncover evidence and create a documentary and expose the truth in the case, those men in prison feel a sense of freedom, a sense that a weight's been lifted off their chest. Obviously, they want out of prison, but for so many people, they just want the truth out there. And I think our students are coming to realize that the work that they're doing has so much of an impact on those individuals' lives that they don't want to walk away from this type of work. I can't tell you how many students this semester have said that they, after this class ends, when they graduate, they want to get involved in some aspect of the criminal justice system, because they realize that these are human beings, there are lives that are being impacted, and they want to help change the system for the greater good.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
We know there are many, many cases out there that aren't even getting looked at. What's your process for bringing a case in to even put before the students? Do you have a submission process where people submit ideas or cases, or are you personally looking for them?
We do. I mean, I think the first time around when this was brand new, we were out looking for cases, and through Marty's network, we were able to find some really good cases. But since that cohort led to an exoneration and that got a lot of media attention, we now are flooded. And I mean flooded with letters from prison, with emails from family members, desperate for us to look at cases. And it's really hard because we can only pick five each year. And we now have hundreds that we have to go through. So we have a process. We're looking for a variety of different things in cases. We bring usually somewhere from 10 to 20 forward to our students before each cohort, each class, each semester, I mean. And we let the students pick the cases that they want to work on. But it's a very hard process. It also means we disappoint a lot of people who are desperately hoping that we'll take their case and we can't do enough. And I think that just speaks to how vast the number of wrongful convictions is, the injustice, the suffering of families. It's not just the person too, it's of the families who, as they say, do the time with them. And, you know, we do the best we can to have a fair, transparent process. But it's painful. I'm not going to lie. You know, while we rejoice in the cases we can work on and we come to love these people and their families and really care about them, we also know that there are a lot of people whose cases we can't work on, or at least not in that given year. So it's a difficult process, but, you know, one we can do with the resources we have in the best way we can.
And I think one of the big issues, too, is that I can't tell you how often Mark and I hear, well, can't you guys replicate this program, and how come this program can't be taught somewhere else? And there's one big issue. There's no Mark and Marty. When our students get to come to class and they see Mark and I, they see somebody who is exonerated, which is what they're striving for, and they're seeing somebody who fought for their friend. So they get to see kind of the whole package in one aspect every time they come to class. And I think that is so important that you can't replicate. You can't replicate somebody who fought for their childhood friend, who changed their whole career, who has the background that Mark does. And you can't replicate, you know, in an average person, somebody who was wrongfully incarcerated for 18 years, who has seen more cases like this than most lawyers. And the students get to really experience something different every time, you know, they come to class. They get to hear real life stories. We've brought exonerees to speak to the class. They get to work with some of the country's leading experts. And, you know, some said, you know, how come you can't teach this twice a year? If people knew the amount of work that went into one semester, I think they would also understand it can't be done. And you have to review 100 cases, and then you have to do follow-ups on each one of those cases to find out, do you have lawyers? Do you have the records? Because for us, it's one of the most important aspects of taking a case is that we want the individual to have access to their entire court file. The first day of class, once they pick a case, they have access to court transcripts, police reports, medical examiner reports. And by the second or third week, they have a better grasp of the case than probably their trial lawyers did. And I think that's one of the most difficult things that we have to tell people that reach out to us, that if you don't have the case files, it's not a case we can take right now, because it just takes too long to assemble that. And if you think about some of these cases, they've been in prison for 10, 15, 20, 30 years.
If you could, gentlemen, share any links or books that you would recommend that people check out.
For any listeners who want to learn more about our program, about our cases, it's run through the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown. We have a YouTube channel where we make available all of the documentaries that our students have created. We hope there will soon be a documentary and perhaps documentary series about our program as well. There are a lot of resources about wrongful convictions through the Innocence Project, of course. And if anyone is interested more generally in larger issues of criminal justice reform and the problems of criminal justice in the United States, my 2017 book, Unusually Cruel, Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism, is something that I'd be happy to recommend.
I mean, I think anybody who wants to really get involved can find something to do. So often I hear people say, well, I'm just an average citizen. We're living in a time where average citizens can help raise money. They can raise social awareness. They can, if they're technologically savvy, they can help develop websites, social media platforms. I think what we have now is the ability to reach a larger population than ever before. In a lot of these wrongful conviction cases, there are witnesses or individuals who possess knowledge about the case that they may not realize could have some impact. What we try to describe wrongful conviction cases are like a big puzzle. And sometimes an individual may possess just one piece of the puzzle and have no idea that one little piece of the puzzle could solidify another piece of it. So by creating social media platforms or hotlines, it gives those individuals an opportunity to come forward and give information. I can tell you in my case, we created a hotline, the West Memphis 3 case, there was a hotline. And in addition to the Innocence Project, there's the National Registry of Exonerations that people can go to get information. Obviously, you know, Barry Scheck has books about criminal justice and innocence. There's so much literature out there. What I would say is that one of the best starting points, too, is going to, let's say, the Innocence Project, reading their website, but also understanding that DNA exonerations are a very small percentage of the exonerations that take place nationally. And when you think about how many exonerations take place every year, that number should scare people. I think last year, the year before, on average every year, it's about every two to three days, there's another exoneration. And those numbers should scare you because if you think about how limited number of people or people who are doing this work and we're able to achieve that, to me, it just shows us that we need more people to do this work. And unfortunately, for some of that really does require resources. Because when you think about the time that gets invested into doing the work, it can be all consuming. If you ask law firms that have worked on these cases and you ask them how many billable hours they've spent on a case, some can give you the exact number or some will say so many that we stop keeping track of them. But I will say it is the most rewarding work anyone can ever do. There's not a person, a lawyer, an expert witness that has ever been involved in an exoneration that doesn't say it's one of the best days of their life. I'm sure you can ask Mark that other than the birth of his kids and marriage to Lise, you know, being there when I walked out of prison and when Valentina walked out of prison have got to be in the top 10, you know, best moments of his life. And I'll tell you, there's not a lawyer who will walk away and not want to do this. But I think for your listeners, there is so much that can be done. Don't shy away from wrongful conviction cases. While they're challenging, when you run from them, there is no success. And I think our undergraduate students are able to demonstrate that success can be achieved with the right assemblage of a team and having passion.
you're two human beings. You have your own lives. You're working with students, lawyers, professors. Your plates are pretty full as is. So hopefully we'll continue to hear of others who are working to free people who have been wrongly convicted.
Well, I mean, if you think about when the Innocence Project started in the early 90s, there was one. Now I think we're over 70, quote unquote, Innocence Projects around the world. I wouldn't call what we do an Innocence Project. It's Innocence Work. And there are even reporters like Dan Slepian and Aaron Moriarty who have taken up wrongful conviction cases, helped investigate them, and helped achieve exonerations. And I think if we can do what we do to achieve exonerations, if reporters can get involved and get exonerations, I think lawyers should also be more open to working with us and our students and having a better understanding that so much of the criminal justice system, in some ways, is about public opinion. And our students really do a great job in educating people. Nobody is trying to, you know, pull the wool over anyone's eyes. Our students are truth seekers. And, you know, if you look at their documentaries, they're just presenting facts. And I think that's so important for society to understand that these cases, you know, there's a human side to it, but there's a truth side to it. And, you know, Lonnie Story, who is the individual that led the campaign to free me, has consistently said that we need to humanize those individuals who are incarcerated. So when people look at the cases, we don't automatically say, oh my God, that's somebody who's wrongfully convicted of murder. You know, when we identified Valentina Dixon, it was Valentina Dixon was a son, a father, you know, a grandson, an artist, an advocate, and then somebody who was wrongfully convicted of murder. Because if society automatically says, oh my God, that person's in jail for murder, there may not be a connection. So we need to develop a connection with people. And I think what will happen is then what we'll do is we'll transcend into having a better understanding of the system. I also believe that we need to expose the success stories of exonerees. So when judges are considering whether or not to release somebody, they can have the confidence that the level of success of prior exonerees is so high that there shouldn't be a fear to release someone.
If you recall the movie, The Silence of the Lambs, which I also read the book, but they're talking about how the killer can operate. The killer operates by not seeing the humanity of the person in front of them. And so to work against that, we need to work the opposite way. We need to be able to see who they are and find out who they are so that we understand we're fighting for a human being here. It's not just some convicted person. It's not a statistic.
That's absolutely right. And one thing I wanted to add, it's amazing about exonerees, and I'd put Marty first and foremost among them, because you have to remember Marty was, you know, victimized doubly by losing his parents and then going to prison for it. That's just a level of suffering that's just unimaginable. But, you know, many people would think that someone like Marty or and other exonerees would just be angry and bitter and vindictive. And the truth is that's rare. There are a few, a handful that we know, but for the most part, they are positive. And what they want to do is give back and they want to help others and they want to push for criminal justice reform. And it's not only, I should add, about other people wrongfully convicted, because our criminal justice system eats up people, has insanely long sentences far beyond what other countries do. Our prison conditions are horrific. And there are a lot of people who have made mistakes, who did commit their crimes, who have aged out, who have transformed, and who want nothing more than to return to society and make a positive contribution. And I should mention also that I've recently started a nonprofit organization called the Frederick Douglass Project for Justice. And the goal of the signature project of that organization is to bring in ultimately tens of thousands of people from the outside to bring them inside of prisons around the country so that they have an opportunity to meet and interact with incarcerated people and discover their humanity. Because ultimately what all the work I'm doing is about, whether it's on wrongful convictions and pushing for exonerations, but also for prison reform and prison education, is really about getting society to open up its hearts and to connect with people who are incarcerated to support them. And so there's a deeper, broader humanizing project that's very closely connected with this work.
But for our students, the humanization, I can't tell you how often we say that that icing on the cake connection for many of our students is when they go into the prisons and get to visit our clients. I mean, we call them our clients, even though we're not, quote unquote, representing them. One of the student groups got to go up to Rhode Island and meet with, one of the guys. And for them, it was that defining moment. You know, cause we always ask, before you get to visit them, do you believe in their innocence? How much do you believe in their innocence? And there hasn't been a case yet where when our students met with the individual in prison, that they didn't walk away with this positive feeling. This is a human being and the work that the students were doing was right. It was just. And so many of the students got to confront the individuals and ask them anything they wanted. And they all walked away with this feeling that they were innocent, which I think, For Mark and I, it just shows us how important it is to create that human connection because we've said to every individual, don't lie to us. Our students are really good investigators and they will uncover anything and everything you can think about. When I was in prison, I used to have the Marty litmus test where when guys used to come up to me and say, I'm innocent, can you help me? So I used to say, okay, you're willing to take a polygraph? Are you willing to do a DNA test? Are you willing to do anything else that's possible to prove your innocence? And the guys who went, yes, yes, yes. I was like, okay, let's talk. And in almost every one of the cases, when they've done the Marty litmus test, we get yes, yes, yes. And it actually just happened recently. We had a Zoom call with the individual and the students did the Marty litmus test. And the guy in jail said, I'll take a polygraph test. I'll take a DNA test. Any test you want me to do, I will do. And I think it's a powerful statement to our students for them to really walk away feeling that this guy will do whatever it's possible to prove their innocence.
That's a good amount of trust as well to say, I am putting myself in your hands.
Well, for me, the guys that said, well, polygraphs really aren't that reliable and, they're not admissible in this state and, I used to be like, but that's not the point. The point I was looking for is that gut reaction where an individual is so innocent that he just espouses innocence in every aspect. And it's just spewing out of his body saying, I will do whatever I have to do to prove my innocence. There's nothing I won't do. And when you get this reaction, it's interesting when I talk about polygraphs, Valentino, against his lawyer's wishes, wrote to the DA, said, listen, I want to take a polygraph. And if you give me a polygraph, ask every other witness if they'd be willing to take one. And oddly enough, Valentino was the only one that took one and he passed it. And for the prosecutors up there, it was like the icing on the cake.
If you have any final thoughts, I'd like to hear them.
I'll let Mark go first.
Well, I just think it's important for listeners to understand that this is not an isolated, marginal issue, that this goes to the core of the American criminal justice system. This goes to the core of American society and culture, and that we've uncovered a deep and broad fundamental problem that we desperately need to fix. And I hope that people feel compelled to take action, to support organizations that do take action, and really to keep spreading the word about injustice that takes place every single day in America. Because until it gets fixed, I think we'll never live up to the ideals that are written out in our founding documents and other aspects of the American creed.
So many innocent people are convicted based on intentional acts. And that's where we need to change the system and educate people about those intentional acts. And I think once we understand those intentional acts, we can correct the system. One of the things that I think should happen nationally is that every time we identify a wrongful conviction and an exoneration has taken place, we undertake a sentinel review. Kind of like when somebody dies in hospital and everybody gets together, we find out what went wrong, how did it happen? Because I think if we do that in these cases, we will correct the entire criminal justice system. I recently spoke to somebody and they said they didn't want to focus on wrongful convictions because it really doesn't affect the front end of the criminal justice system. And I said, you are so far gone and wrong in that. Because I said, if you think about it, somebody was convicted at trial, their appeals lost, they've been incarcerated for 20 years. If we understand what went wrong from day one, okay, it's something that we can look at. It, have we fixed that in the system as it exists today? And I think that is one of the biggest things that Mark does, is that we help to identify the criminal justice system and various aspects that we can change. And when exoneration takes place, we need to expose each and every one of those problems that led to that innocent person being in prison for all those decades. Because if you think about what happens, is it's just a destructive process on so many levels. Because where was the guilty party for 20 years? What if they were, you know, committing crimes for 20 years and all of a sudden the prosecutor's office realized that that individual was responsible for a crime someone else was in prison for? At times, we know that they become an agent of the state because we didn't want it exposed. I mean, I remember a few years ago, there was a wrongful conviction in New York State, and the federal government was investigating a drug gang. And during a debriefing in the federal case, the individual said, hey, there's some innocent guys in prison. We committed those crimes. If you think about it, had that not happened and had the prosecutors not turn the information over, you know, how long would the innocent people still remain in prison? So I think we need a better job of really investigating, identifying the issues, retraining of state and federal prosecutors. And really, it's almost a re-education process nationally.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with both of you. And I know so many out there do care. They'd like to get involved in some way, even if it's just raising awareness. So it's good to hear that every little bit helps.
Well, it's great to be with you, Aaron. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Aaron. And I just want to say that it really does help. I mean, we recently had an exoneree speak to our class through a reporter, and he was just so thankful that undergraduate students were doing this work because, you know, when you're in prison and you're just languishing in prison and you feel no one is out there listening to you, fighting for you, it just becomes a downward spiral. When you have someone out there, whether it's a student, a family member, a friend, a lawyer that's fighting for you and helping to expose what happened to you, it gives you the will and the desire to move forward and continue fighting every day. Because so many innocent people in prison don't know how to fight. And if you think about it, you know, so many people on the outside don't know how to fight. They don't even know who to turn to. And I think one of the biggest points I can make for your listeners is don't stop. Be persistent. Keep writing people. Keep emailing people. Keep texting people. Keep sending messages on social media. You know, there's a guy who does this motivational speaking. And when, you know, people come up and say, you know, I'm trying to get this company interested, and his answer is, well, you know, how many messages have you sent? He goes, 20. And he goes, how many? What do you mean 20? It's like 20 each day? And they go, no, 20 in the last month. He goes, there's your problem. Okay. I wrote over 50,000 letters to people in prison. If you're on the outside and you want to get people involved, be persistent. Be that pain in the butt that continues to write to somebody. And, you know, when you want to write to somebody, you also want to be, say, I want to be a team member. I think for all of us, that when we're doing this work, when we get a lawyer or a family member that says, please help, I want to help you. I want to work with you. I have the case files. It just inspires us to say, what else is there? And I think each one of your listeners can do that in so many different ways.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.